German writer Andreas Weber is both a biologist and a philosopher, but that doesn't begin to explain how unique his work is. You could maybe call him a mystical scientist with a transcendental perspective on concepts like the carbon cycle and metabolic processes. He can tell you about the biochemical composition of a flower, but he's more interested in talking about what it might be like to be that flower, to feel the texture of the soil, to eat rays of sunlight. Andreas has a new book out in which he says life is all about eating and being eaten, which may sound gruesome, but as Steve Paulson discovered, it's also kind of miraculous. The book is Being Edible, Toward a Mystical Biology.
So that's where I want to start. What does it mean to be edible?
Yeah, it might sound a bit startling at first. Being edible means being eaten, actually.
Yeah.
And the mutual edibility is, to me, one of the huge secrets of the living cosmos, that life feeds on life and every life needs to live from life. So we could stop here and look at the food web and nature red in tooth and claw and all this, but I would rather go to this amazing realization that in order to exist, every being needs to continuously rebuild itself from the stuff of other lives. Mm-hmm. Life is about transformation.
So one way to think about this is, of course, when we die, we will decompose and our molecules or whatever.
And you know, I would really put it like this. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say we will decompose, because decomposing is actually a process of being eaten.
Mm, yeah.
I see it like this. When I die, I will be a feast for other beings. Like, you know, the roast turkey, mm-hmm. or in Germany, you have the Christmas goose, family tradition, you know, and you have this great day with your family, and it's just lovely to have this ritual in a way. And it will be like this. So there will be beings ecstatic about growing their bodies by transforming your body into theirs. And I find this absolutely spectacular. Hmm. So if we call it decomposing, we already have a very static look.
Or a very sort of negative look.
Very negative look. I mean, let's not hide that, of course, death is a huge challenge, but it also is always a rebirth.
There's another reference point here that I immediately thought about, and that is the Eucharist, eating the bread and
yes.
wine in
yes.
the Catholic Mass, you know, which
yes.
means you're becoming the body yes. and flesh of Jesus.
Yes.
How directly are you drawing that analogy?
Yeah, I actually don't draw it at all consciously. Of course, I have realized how you could look back at the Christian idea or the Christian tradition of the Eucharist and more deeply understand that this is actually about life and about life-giving. Mm-hmm. And so you could learn about how to understand the divine in terms of a living reality, a living universe, a life-giving reality.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that your project is to take us back into our bodies,
yeah.
which is, maybe that's obvious, but it's not, because it seems like there's this tendency, especially in Western culture, to think of us as just minds.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole push of generative artificial intelligence. We don't need our bodies. At some point, we're going to download consciousness into
yes.
machines, and this is fundamentally counter to everything you're talking about.
Yeah, it's true. That's why I also would really be careful by even using the word artificial intelligence, because intelligence, as I define it, needs a body. I think what we can see, actually we can see in the world and we can see in ourselves, is that every flavor of mind always has a material side. You are matter, and you're also the inside of matter, which I think is just an amazing privileged position. You know, I had this moment of revelation, actually, when I was, and I write about it in this book, when I was standing at the shore of the Mediterranean in one October night. I was in some residency in Italy, and there was a colleague, a filmmaker, I think she was a filmmaker, and she was there, and she was cheering at the waves. It was stormy, and the waves were crashing on the rocks, and she was cheering them on. And I was asking her, why are you so happy? And she said, I have no idea, but it makes me so happy. She just had a cosmic realization. And I was thinking, actually, it is so crazily amazing that I am matter from this world, when I understand the ensouledness of everything. Then it's already like, you know, I'm conceptually preparing a mystical experience, actually.
Mm. There's a beautiful passage you have in one of your essays. You tell a story about how you were sitting in a city park, soaking in all the sights and sounds, the birds, the trees, the wind. And then the outside somehow became the inside. Mm. And these experiences can be hard to put into words. But can you sort of walk me through that whole experience?
Yes.
Going into the park, what you were feeling, sensing all around you, and then what happened?
On that day, in that park, I met with a friend just to have a look at the early spring flowers. Early March, I think, or late February. So the time when, in Europe, these flowers who blossom only when there are not really leaves yet, they come out. It was just a sort of flower sightseeing. There were already some crocii, I think that's the word in...
Crocuses?
Crocuses. And snowdrops, and I found it very beautiful, but that's far too shallow to talk about. I would say I had a pull which I felt somehow going to my heart, somehow pulling my heart somewhere. It was a sort of call, I would say. Come closer to what you really see here, these flowers, these blossoms. So I sat down and was thinking, okay, so I will try to somehow take them into my heart, be on that emotional level, be very present, and just sit there. In a way, I just resolved to do a meditation, and the friend did the same, so we didn't really talk a lot. We just sat down on some low fence. And then I was basically not doing anything but just trying to stay present. So I didn't really think. I cultivated something like asking, somehow being to be really, somehow be on the same level as the flowers in a way. I looked at the flowers, I looked at the branches which had no leaves and which somehow crisscrossed the pale sky. So it just popped up that I saw that all these connections of transformations, the flowers who drink the light and make their bodies from the carbon dioxide they breathe in, which I breathe out. This was some incredibly tender, intimate relational process. I was somehow part of it. I was somehow inside of it. I was somehow... It's a slightly psychedelic experience, actually. You somehow dissolve. You lose your solid ego, in a way. It was incredibly beautiful.
It's sort of like you've, I don't know, become one of the flowers. Almost.
Yeah, it's a little bit like this. Yeah, you know, you really tempt me to try a little experience outside, because many people have had this experience, but it doesn't pop up so often if you do not cultivate it. And you can cultivate it, and then you can, I would even say you can learn to go into this mode of understanding this. But that's also part of my practice when I do workshops, to really try to open up for participants to walk into this perception, which I think has been the cultural norm for many ancient cultures, animistic cultures, who didn't see nature. They didn't have a concept of nature, but they had a concept of other subjects, other non-human persons, other than human persons with whom they share their lives, with whom they could interact, with whom they could shift shapes. So we can really go in the direction of these experiences without taking any substances. You see, this has really become my passion.
Sure, yeah.
To do it totally sober, you know? Teetotal psychedelic experiences. Only helped by the flowers. I mean, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. So I want to ask you about where this perspective on the world has come from for you personally. And I want to go back to your childhood, because you've written about how at quite an early age, I think maybe even before you were a teenager, you became an avid gardener.
Yeah.
And this wasn't just going out and planting a few vegetables. This was more than that.
Yeah, that's true. That was actually, it was a philosophical approach to gardening. I'm still obsessed with perceptions which come from my early childhood, actually. It's this childlike wonder about reality, you know, just looking at it and saying, wow.
How old were you?
I was maybe 12, maybe even a bit earlier. So it was on the other side of the street. Somebody had a garden there, and this guy moved, and the garden fell fallow. And I was looking at it, and I don't know. I just had this idea I could grow vegetables. And I asked my father if he could somehow talk to this guy, and it was a very low rent, actually. So my father paid that for me, but that was the only help, actually, he gave me. So everything was up to me, which was somehow a bit terrible, but also great because I could do it as I wanted to do it. I bought literature. I spent my whole pocket money, you know, I spent on books, gardening books. In the wintertime, I made these drawings, which goes where, you know, where cabbage goes in that plot. And I was there every afternoon, I think. I had my little dachshund with me, and I also had a friend who was always helping. It was paradise. Only the attractive girls didn't look at me anymore. really, it was a high price I had to pay, you know. And at some point, I stopped gardening. So it became too serious. It was really, you know, I was this freak. You know, I was deeply in love with one girl for years in this innocent way, you know. And no, she didn't really look at me. And then there was this moment. I came back from the local farmer who had sold me 2 carts of manure. And I was so proud. Actually, it was fraud. I paid far too much. I had no idea, but okay. I was proud with this cart full of manure, and I met this girl. She came with her bike and she saw me, and I saw her. I was really hoping to have some eye contact and to show her my love through my eyes. And she looked at me and I saw really my
this kid with my cause, manure.
My cause had failed. It was super humiliating.
Why do you think that was so magical for you? What was it about what you were doing then that made you obsessed?
Very good question, because then I didn't really know. It was beautiful black earth, wonderful earth, with lots of earthworms inside. There was also a blackbird who was also always there, and the blackbird wanted the worms, so the blackbird started to chide at me when I stopped turning the earth. That was very funny. And the dog also started to bark, because the dog had his own tunnel excavation project, and when I stopped, because I needed a break, because I was only 11, the blackbird started to screech at me, because he wanted more worms. And the dog also, because the dog thought I was kind of like leaving him alone in his huge building project. So it was actually very relational. And then I sowed salad and herbs and cabbage and beans, peas and carrots. And I mean, it was just wonderful and beautiful when in the evening with the sun setting, I was walking there and just looked at what was growing. I was gifted. I gave my labor and I was given back something, and that was wonderful. And then I could give this obviously to my family or to my friend's family, so we ate it also. That was also wonderful. So I would say I was just simply part of this circle of edibility. I made myself edible in terms of really toiling and sweating. So I really, really gave myself away into this. But then the garden gave itself away to me. This very short circuit of giving and receiving. And then I could give away that what I had received.
So there's something else that you write about in one of your essays that I found so interesting, and that's the boundaries that exist between the inner and outer world. So for the cell, it's the membrane. For a tree, it's bark. Mm-hmm. For vertebrates, the blood-brain barrier. Mm-hmm. The skin,
yes,
of the
of
human
course,
body.
We have several of these.
Yeah,
yes.
And the point that you make is that all of these boundaries are both protective casings. They sort of hold what's inside. They're also permeable.
Yeah. You know, that came to me also when I met a tree in spring, and I saw that this tree in the forest close to my place in Berlin. We went into this forest like regularly with my dog, and it was early spring, and I saw that this tree, I really see it like today, that somehow the bark had opened and the green shoot came from this bark at a place where before there was only bark. I was thinking, life is just both. Life is a wall and it is an opening. Life is a refusal and it is an emphatic yes. And it is both at the same time, a wall that is a door. So it always means that living beings create themselves as being separate through being connected. You could even say that your respiration is this membrane, because what you do, now it's another instance of being super edible. What you do when you breathe out is that you breathe out CO2, carbon dioxide, and the C, the carbon in this, is your flesh. That's how it works. It's your fat, it's your protein, it's your meat. If you look into how the cell metabolism functions, what goes out as CO2 is part of the living being. You know, children are taught in school that we eat like cars are refueled, and then the food is burned, gives us energy, and then there's some exhaust. This is like biologically not right. It's wrong. It doesn't happen like this. It's because the food which you eat becomes yourself, becomes your flesh. That's the continuum. You eat the apple, and you become the apple. You become the apple tree. And you breathe out yourself. So this blue sky is actually made by the bodies of all these beings who breathe out every 2 seconds. Or even more often. And then you're breathing your body into the bodies of the trees and the plants. I find this so mysterious.
It's so beautiful.
We are one huge continuum of bodies. That's, for example, something you can exercise with participants in a workshop, just to do this very slowly, like a meditation.
What do you mean? What do you do?
To sit with a tree and breathe and see how your feeling is. And I tell you from my experience with these workshops is actually things happen. It's not just you sit there and breathe. Things happen, like people come, and sometimes people have this revelatory experiences. Like I had a participant in a workshop 2 weeks ago. She said, you know, suddenly I was the forest. People were walking through me, which is very profound, you know. On a certain level of our embodied nature, it's also plain truth. She had a deep insight in reality. People come back and they're so happy about them. But it's not so difficult to have them. You need some time. You need some patience. But I have become very confident that people can go very quickly, very deep, actually, because fundamentally, this is our experience. I remember last year, there was a student, I did this for a seminar of a colleague at the Berlin University. And there was a student who looked at me and said, hey, this is actually like taking mushrooms. And I said, yes, but without taking mushrooms, you know.
Right.
It's just sitting with mushrooms. You don't need any object. You don't need to consume anything. You can just be it. And yeah. It's possible. It's possible. It needs some training, but it's in ourselves.
That's Andreas Weber, a biologist and philosopher based in Berlin. He was talking with Steve Paulson about his book, Being Edible, Toward a Mystical Biology. It's not out in English yet, but while you're waiting, check out his earlier book with an equally great title, The Biology of Wonder.